Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop update on the treatment of pancreatic cancer. This is part one of a two-part series on living with pancreatic cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and I particularly want to also call out to the particular pancreatic cancer organizations that have also helped to spread the word about the program. So I want to just mention the Hirschberg Foundation for Pancreatic Cancer Research, the Lustgarten Foundation, and also the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. These are all groups that work with us to help spread the word about this program. And because of all of that promotion and talking about the program, we have over 580 participants on the program today. And you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it really is a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by the Celgene Corporation, Merrimack Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and a contribution from Lilly. And I really want to thank them for their support, not only of today's program, but of this two-part series, and also for their corporate collaboration in making a program like this possible. Now, we have the best of the best speakers on today's program. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly. Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Director of Clinical Research, David M. Rubenstein Center for Pancreatic Cancer, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. O'Reilly is going to present an overview of pancreatic cancer, current standard of care, and new and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
Thank you, Carolyn, very much for the introduction, and welcome, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Greetings from New York. So for the next 12 minutes or so, just going to review a little bit about the background of pancreas cancer, discuss the epidemiology and genetics, and the current state of the art and where the field is going in terms of new treatment approaches. So just some points to bring to your attention that pancreas cancer is a relatively common disease. We anticipate that a little over 50,000 people will be diagnosed in the U.S. this year. And that number is on the rise. It's really not fully understood why that is so. Part of it may relate to the population getting older and this being a disease of slightly older people in that the average age of diagnosis is in one's early 70s. So that's in contrast, for example, to lung, breast, and colon cancer and prostate cancer, where incidences have leveled off and even in some cases begun to decline. So a number of distinctions for pancreas cancer, but that's one of them. This disease is considered challenging for a number of reasons. It's a genomically relatively complex disease. The cancer itself, in particular the primary tumor that originates in the pancreas, often has a sort of a complex environment that supports the pancreas cancer cells. We call that the stroma, and that may act as a barrier to effective drug delivery and also perhaps in terms of having the right immune cells in the environment. And this disease, we don't have any what we call biomarkers or substances that we measure either in an individual or in the tumor that we use for routine decision making. So genetically complex disease and, as I say, a number of unique features about this cancer. In terms of risk factors, we mentioned being older is one of the key risk factors. Cigarette smoking is associated with pancreas cancer, and the longer one smokes and the greater amount that one smokes contributes to an increased risk. Overall, probably accounts for about a quarter of the incidence of this disease. So from a public health perspective, that's a key issue, and we counsel patients and families because they're now advocates for the disease to encourage people not to smoke. lifestyle factors can be associated, so high body mass index or obesity, lack of physical activity, high fat, low fiber diets over lifetime. These factors may also contribute to the risk of the disease. And then a couple of other contexts, certain types of pancreatitis or inflammation of the pancreas may increase the risk of pancreatic cancer. And longstanding diabetes confers a slightly higher risk of this disease. There's a separate type of diabetes that can be associated with a presentation of pancreas cancer, and in fact it sometimes can be an early tip-off that something might be underpinning that identification of diabetes. We can see that for a couple of years for some patients prior to the overt presentation with the cancer. And the other major point to note is that about 10, maybe 15% of people with pancreas cancer can have a genetic predisposition to this disease, and there are a number of well-defined genetic syndromes that we inquire about in terms of asking about family and personal history of malignancy, although for a number of families there may not be any of these genes that are changed, but yet there is a frequency of pancreas cancer in that family, and that's probably the bigger group of people with a genetic predisposition, and a lot of work in both of these areas, because this might provide in selected circumstances an opportunity for screening healthy individuals in families where we know they may be at higher risk for developing pancreas cancer. And so that's a kind of an important area, and it's also important from the treatment point of view. So moving to how we think about this disease, there's sort of three groups of people with pancreas cancer as they present with this disease. A small percentage of people will have localized pancreas cancer, which is free of blood vessel involvement and no spread or metastasis of the cancer, where they're candidates for either upfront surgery and postoperative treatment, or sometimes these days we'll recommend initial what we call systemic therapy or chemotherapy, and then follow on by surgery. That's about 15% of people with pancreas cancer. The next group has localized pancreas cancer, but the tumor involves blood vessels that precludes a complete removal of the cancer at the time point of their diagnosis. And in a percentage of people, we can downstage the tumor by treating with chemotherapy and radiation and facilitate a future surgery. And that's an area that's where treatment approaches are in flux. And then about half of people who are diagnosed with this disease will come to medical attention at the time where metastases are present. And the major areas include the liver, lungs, abdominal cavity, and lymph nodes. And typically in the setting of metastatic disease, an operation or radiation or what we call local-based approaches don't make sense for that particular patient. So that's called clinical staging, and just going back to the group of people who undergo surgery initially, for those that have tumors in the head or center portion of the pancreas, the type of operation is called a Whipple surgery, which involves removal of the head of the pancreas, usually the gallbladder, and reconnecting the bile duct and the pancreatic duct, and it's a somewhat significant reconstruction of the upper gastrointestinal tract. That's about 5 to 7 days or 8 days in the hospital, and then typically 4 to 8 weeks in terms of recuperation. And then usually we'll recommend postoperative or what's called adjuvant therapy. That's therapy designed to try and eliminate any microscopic cells and to try and maximize the chances of the cancer not returning. In the setting of metastatic disease, that's where the cancer spread. As we mentioned, the primary treatment is typically chemotherapy-based treatment. There are a couple of common choices that are considered. One combination of medications is called FOLFIRINOX. That's a program of drugs that's been adopted from our European colleagues, involving medication called oxaliplatin, medication called irinotecan, 5-FU or 5-fluorouracil, and a vitamin called leucovorin. That treatment is partly given in the clinic and partly people will go home with a home infusion cartridge and then cycled every 2 weeks. So that's for fit, vigorous people. That's a common initial treatment choice. Another combination that would be considered is using gemcitabine and a drug called nab-paclitaxel. That's given on a weekly schedule. Slightly different side effects, although both have in common fatigue, low blood counts, something called neuropathy, which is some pins and needles, numbness, and sometimes lack of dexterity in terms of physical functioning in the fingers and toes. And there are symptoms and side effects that we monitor closely for. And for one of these combinations, there can be more hair loss than with the other. Another very important consideration for patients who are interested and where the circumstances related to their disease permits is the idea of clinical trials. And that can be looking at the addition of experimental medications to these standard medications. And Dr. Straff will further elaborate on this whole concept in a few minutes. But that's a key part of our discussion is consideration of clinical trials in terms of treatment-related studies, in terms of genetic-related studies and specimen collection in terms of analyzing tumor or analyzing the blood over time, looking for genetic factors related to the cancer in the blood, which are sort of new ways of evaluating what the status of a person's cancer might be in terms of a future direction. So they are the main approaches for metastatic disease. And last year we had the advent of an additional drug called liposomal irinotecan combined with fluorouracil and leucovorin as a follow-on treatment, in particular for patients who receive gemcitabine as the initial part of their care or gemcitabine-based treatments. So they're all standard options. In the setting of localized pancreas cancer, where surgery may or may not be a future consideration, radiation is considered as an option, not necessarily as the initial step, but sometimes as a follow-on to chemotherapy, sometimes combined with chemotherapy, or sometimes using radiation on its own as a in a high-dose fashion over a limited number of days as a method of securing what we call local tumor control and optimizing the control of the cancer in the primary area and trying to facilitate removal of the tumor away from blood vessels, which can be sometimes a challenging issue, especially if tumors are encased in blood vessels. It may not be actually feasible to do that. So there are the current standards for localized, for locally advanced, and for metastatic pancreas cancer. I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes just highlighting some of the areas in terms of where the field is moving in the investigational or novel treatment approaches. And the good news is that there are a lot of very exciting things happening in pancreas cancer. One strategy from the clinical trial perspective is trying to target this physical environment that supports pancreas cancer cells. That's the stroma that we mentioned at the beginning. So there are drugs that are in the clinic that are designed to try and break down that physical barrier to get the immune cells in, to try and get chemotherapeutic agents in, and to affect greater local delivery and what we call systemic delivery of treatment. So there are late-stage clinical trials in that area. Another very important area is the area of genetic profiling and what we can do about that information and treatments. So to divert a moment, about 5 to 7 or 8% of people with pancreas cancer will develop the disease in the background of a BRCA 1 or 2 mutation. This occurs a little bit more commonly in people with Ashkenazi or Eastern European heritage, but certainly we see it in any background setting in this disease. And it's important for the individual in that there are now treatment approaches in the clinic using selected chemotherapy drugs and experimentally a class of drugs called PARP inhibitors, which are evaluating the effectiveness in people with pancreas cancer that arise in this setting. But the additional importance is that if we identify a BRCA mutation in an individual that's arising in what we call their germline, so potentially inherited in the family, then it's very important that we evaluate other family members for their risk of other cancers that may be related to that BRCA mutation, as well as in, for selected families, consider screening for pancreas cancer. So that's a very active area of research. And I'll mention one last area in terms of where the field is currently evaluating what the role of immunotherapy is in pancreas cancer. And immunotherapy has obviously been a very exciting field in oncology over the last number of years, and major progress has been made in a number of key diseases like lung cancer and melanoma and bladder cancer. Perhaps we haven't been as yet quite as fortunate in pancreas cancer. Nonetheless, there are a lot of strategies underway looking at combination of immune therapy approaches, immune therapy with chemotherapy and radiation, and hopefully over the next 18 months to 2 years we'll understand which of these approaches are meaningful in the clinic. So thank you very much. I'll stop there and pass the line back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Reilly, for really an outstanding overview of pancreatic cancer and also some of the genomic features of it, and just really some of the ways that it's treated, so people can have a better understanding of this, of how pancreatic cancer is approached. And our next speaker is Dr. Rachna Shroff. Dr. Shroff is Assistant Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal, GI Medical Oncology, Department of Cancer Medicine, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Shroff is going to address the role of clinical trials, pain and symptom management, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Shroff.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and thank you all for participating and engaging it with us, and we look forward to all of your questions. Dr. O'Reilly did a fantastic job of giving an overview of pancreatic cancer, and so I'm going to focus first a little bit on, I think, the last point that she touched on, which are some of the new and exciting approaches to trying to really break this field wide open, and that's really through the role of clinical trials in treating pancreatic cancer. So just like she alluded to, you know, we really try our best to integrate clinical trials into practice as early as possible, because it is the way in which future discoveries can be found, but also potentially new and novel approaches for each of our patients. Coming from a place like MD Anderson or Memorial Sloan Kettering, we obviously are going to encourage early referral to a tertiary referral center where there's active pancreatic cancer research ongoing, and that's really primarily so that the patient can be part of the system and we can decide when the appropriate use of a clinical trial may be. If you sit and Google for clinical trials, if you use some of the major search engines, which I'm going to go into in just a little bit, you'll see that there's, in this country alone, over 2,000 clinical trials that are ongoing with pancreatic cancer at various stages, both localized disease as well as in the advanced or metastatic setting. And so there are a number of different opportunities for clinical trials to be utilized at any stage of the patient's management. What we do know is that most of the major centers have robust clinical trial portfolios within their pancreas cancer group, so medical oncologists or surgical oncologists who are treating pancreatic cancer. And then in addition, there are centers that offer groups such as a phase one program or an early clinical trial program where there are clinical trials that are involving drugs that are earlier along in their development and drug development, but that may have demonstrated some early signals in pancreatic cancer and so could be appropriate for patients as well. I think one of the biggest issues that I have heard recurring from patients is that it's obviously very overwhelming to really know what clinical trials are available, where they're available, and what's open at any given moment, because it is obviously a moving target in terms of which clinical trials are open at any given time. And so some of the resources that are out there that I think are just very, very, very good and very complete include things like clinicaltrials.gov, which is a website that you can go onto and basically type in pancreas cancer or metastatic pancreatic cancer, and you can be provided with a list of studies that are open, and most of them are relatively updated in terms of what's open and recruiting patients versus those that have been completed and are closed to new patients enrolling on them. And so I always encourage patients to use that website, in addition to obviously ongoing conversations with their oncologist, given that a number of oncologists can utilize that website but are also in touch with some of the major pancreas cancer research programs. I believe that Dr. Messner already alluded to some other great foundations and organizations that I think provide a fantastic support and patient advocacy in terms of helping patients navigate the clinical trial pipeline for pancreas cancer, and that includes things such as the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. And I know a number of patients have been able to be kind of plugged in with an advocate who helps them sift through the list of trials available in pancreatic cancer specific to their stage or what line of treatment that they're at and such. And so we really encourage patients to try to reach out to some of these organizations because I think they do a very good job of helping to decipher some of the lingo that I think can be a little complicated and overwhelming. In terms of clinical trials and when and how to integrate them, you know, each of these trials are really broken down into both stage of disease as well as when patients are first enrolling on a study. Are they newly diagnosed and never before treated, or have they received some prior therapy and are now moving on to second options or third options? And so it's really important to understand what your disease state is. Is this localized versus metastatic, like Dr. O'Reilly explained? And then in addition, have you received prior chemotherapy with things such as FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, or have you never before received any therapy? There are trials available for any and all of these patients, and, you know, I think most people who treat pancreatic cancer know that in somebody who is a newly diagnosed metastatic pancreas cancer, for instance, we really like to consider clinical trials that involve some combination of the drugs that we know have worked, such as the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel combination or the FOLFIRINOX combination. And so as a result, you'll see that there are a number of clinical trials available that involve those chemotherapy backbones with the addition of a novel agent or a new drug that perhaps is targeting some of the areas that Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, such as the stroma or genetic modifications related to a BRCA mutation. And so we encourage patients to kind of engage with the clinical providers regarding options for newly diagnosed advanced disease that could involve that chemotherapy, but in addition to a potential novel agent that could help improve outcomes. In the setting of somebody who's already received chemotherapy, there are obviously a number of trials that are in that field because, as Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, there are about 5 or 6 FDA-approved combinations or drugs, really, that are utilized in the advanced pancreas cancer setting. And after that, it's really a little bit more of an open field in terms of what other treatment opportunities we have. And so in that area, we really kind of come down to these areas, these little niches that Dr. O'Reilly was mentioning. And I think what we've learned now with pancreatic cancer is that while this might not be a disease similar to breast cancer where there are clear tissue and blood-based biomarkers that can be tested and utilized for treatment decisions, we are starting to be able to categorize patients, if you will, into some of these groups, such as these patients who may have some sort of a genetically driven pancreas cancer, either with a known mutation such as BRCA or even those who do not have a known mutation but who have family histories that are suggestive of such. And as we start to categorize these patients, we are becoming a little more strategic in terms of helping to funnel patients into specific clinical trials or into at least specific categories of clinical trials. Some of you may have heard about the Precision Promise program that's opening. I know Memorial Sloan Kettering is one of the participants. But there are studies such as that, which is being run through PanCAN, that basically involve patients being assigned to a clinical trial based on what information we gain from either blood or tissue collection. And so, just like Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, we really are trying to seamlessly integrate looking at blood for cancer, circulating cancer cells, or looking at the diagnostic biopsy tissues that we have, or even surgical specimens, to really better understand each individual pancreas cancer patient's tumor so that we can perhaps direct their initial standard therapies and subsequent clinical trials with a little bit more of a strategy as opposed to just pulling something out of a list of clinical trials. So within that realm, there's a number of different types of clinical trials that we're encouraging, which we're encouraging patients to look at, and that includes drugs that are altering stroma. It includes the patients who perhaps have some sort of defect in their DNA repair pathway, which seems to predispose patients to developing pancreas cancer. Or, for instance, immunotherapy, which, as Dr. Riley mentioned, is obviously a big buzzword, and unfortunately, as of yet, has not had the breakthroughs that we've seen in melanoma and lung cancer. But there is a lot of brain power and a lot of time and effort going into better understanding perhaps which pancreatic cancer patients could utilize an approach that uses modifying immune cells to fight the pancreas cancer in specific. So between all of those different approaches, we think that we may be able to be a little more strategic in terms of identifying the right clinical trial for the patient at the right time. I'm going to move on to the pain and symptom management, and I know that Maria is on the line, and obviously some of the major symptoms that we deal with are things related to nutrition and weight loss, and she really is quite the expert in that field. So I'm going to touch more on things related to pain management, in addition to some of the other symptoms that include the obstruction of the main bile duct that runs through the pancreas that can cause jaundice or that yellowing of the skin and eyes. And of course, there are other known symptoms such as things like fatigue and weight loss in addition. The one thing that we can all agree on, I think, as medical oncologists or oncologists who treat pancreas cancer is that the early introduction of a supportive care team or kind of supportive care management alongside of active cancer therapy is really important in pancreas cancer patients. And that's really because patients hear, oh, we'd like to get a palliative care consult. And it's not because we're necessarily saying that we're not going to actively treat the cancer, but we know that there are so many ongoing symptoms, either from the cancer themselves or from the treatments that we're giving them, that require some additional tweaking and monitoring and medication management. And so we really try to encourage patients to get plugged into a palliative care or supportive care program right at the time of diagnosis to really improve their quality of life. What we know is that in terms of pain management, that is an active issue in these patients, and there are a lot of different modalities that we can utilize to better manage pain. We are very, very quick to tell patients that in patients who are on active treatment that's working, admittedly, does typically improve pain in these patients, and that's an important component of their pain management. But oftentimes, that's not enough, and so we typically try to utilize narcotic pain medications first, and, you know, my patients are always very concerned that they're going to get, quote, addicted to these medicines, and I try to educate them on the fact that these pancreas cancer patients have legitimate pain and that narcotic pain medicines are oftentimes a really important part of their treatment plan because it is very limiting and debilitating in terms of what they're able to do if they're in constant pain. That narcotic pain management typically involves a long-acting narcotic medication that you take a few times a day to provide kind of a baseline amount of pain control, and then something that the patients can take in between as needed for when that pain starts to ramp up a little bit. And then obviously when they're on these types of pain medications, we always try to start patients on a bowel regimen to try to keep their stool nice and regular and soft, as constipation can further exacerbate pain. And so we try to keep them on a good regimen that'll keep them regular. The other things that we try to remember to do is that oftentimes one narcotic may kind of lose its punch after some time and that it is important to cycle through medications. And so if a morphine-based medicine is no longer working, it may be reasonable to try a hydromorphone or whatever else your oncologist recommends. The other thing we try to recommend is to start low but to ramp up as needed. And so, you know, pain management will oftentimes start patients on a low dose, especially if they're naive to narcotics. But a quick titration up of medication is often needed, and that's really, that's okay. The other option for pain management includes certain procedures, and so I'm sure a number of you have heard about the nerve blocks that can be provided, and that's really related to the location of the pancreatic tumor in relation to a network of nerves that really runs right behind the pancreas. And so oftentimes when you have a tumor that starts to grow and infiltrates and kind of irritates those nerves, that is a major cause of pain for a lot of our patients. And so these nerve blocks basically can be done endoscopically by using a scope going down your throat versus even through the skin, and it basically injects these nerves and deadens these nerves. And these nerve blocks are definitely effective in a group of patients and are options for patients who perhaps do not get the adequate relief that they need from narcotics. And then there is other direct drug delivery options, such as direct spinal, like epidural delivery of drugs that can hopefully provide a more systemic whole body pain relief for patients who perhaps who are not tolerating oral pain medication or the oral pain medication is not adequate. And then the last thing to touch on is just for patients who do become jaundiced. And so those are patients who turn yellow with the skin in their skin and eyes. And these are patients that are oftentimes they present with jaundice, sometimes even without pain. And so, you know, we know that it is very important to have adequate drainage of that blockage of the bile duct. And it's really just an anatomical thing about where the tumor is in relation to the main bile duct that runs right through your pancreas. As it drains your entire liver and empties into the small intestine. And that is usually very easily remedied by using an endoscope and going in and putting in a bile duct stent into the main stent. Into the main bile duct, and that opens up that obstruction or blockage. And typically then patients really have no subsequent complications from that, and most of them tell us that they feel markedly better after that stent has gone in. And then just I wanted to touch briefly on the communicating about quality of life concerns. You know, the clinical care teams that comprise, you know, medical oncologists, any mid-level providers, nursing, it is very, very important, and we always tell our patients that the goals of care, regardless of whether or not this is a tumor that's going to go straight to the operating room versus a metastatic advanced pancreas cancer, quality of life is really central to our management of these patients, and it is really important to be in constant communication with us and to make sure that we understand your goals of care in addition to us outlining what our hopes and goals are by giving you treatments. And so it is imperative that communication stay open and be ongoing, because some of those things can be in flux. And so when somebody is on chemotherapy, for instance, and like Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, some of our chemotherapies can cause these neuropathies, like pins and needles in your fingers and toes. Well, you know, how much that bothers somebody who is perhaps a concert pianist may be very different than how much it bothers somebody who perhaps does not utilize their hands as much. And so having your clinical care team understand what you do, what your passions are, what your hobbies are, you know, what your day-to-day life looks like and what your goals of treatment are is really important so that we can ensure that we are tailoring our approach to your care appropriately, and that we are maintaining that quality of life not just through symptom management, but also the other things outside of your cancer care that are really important to continuing on and moving forward. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to Dr. Messner. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Strauss. That was very comprehensive and really excellent, and really an excellent review of the clinical trials and in terms of the side effect management, and just really just an excellent presentation, and thank you so much, and we look forward to the questions that will be coming to you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Ms. Maria Petzl. Ms. Petzl is a dietitian. She's senior clinical dietitian, pancreas surgery program, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Ms. Petzl is going to be addressing managing weight loss and eating tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Petzl.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks to all who have joined this call. We appreciate your time. Jumping right in, our goals with nutrition are to really help manage symptoms, to maintain or help improve weight or recover previous weight loss, and to help gain strength. And nutrition can really play a role in maximizing quality of life. Some common concerns for patients with pancreatic cancer are weight loss, pain after eating, diarrhea, pancreatic enzymes, and what to eat. And I'm going to try and cover all of those very quickly here. So weight loss with pancreatic cancer can really be related to kind of three main aspects. One is inadequate intake. This could be due to the side effect of treatment causing poor appetite or taste changes. This could be due to feeling early very quickly, filling up very quickly, or things such as nausea and vomiting. The tumor itself can induce weight loss. It can cause an increase in metabolism and something that we call cancer cachexia, which is a real change in the body's utilization of not just calories but also protein and fats. And malabsorption can be another cause of weight loss, and this is one area that we can really make a big difference. If the malabsorption is related to pancreatic enzyme insufficiency, or malabsorption might be related to rapid transit after surgery or diarrhea related to treatment. Now, regardless of the side effects that someone is having, there are some general tips that really can help with things such as poor appetite, nausea, that early satiety or feeling full quickly. So in general, I recommend that patients eat small, frequent meals. Instead of eating three large meals a day, breaking those meals up to snack-sized meals and eating six or eight meals a day. It can be helpful to plan meals and snacks the day before. This can help eliminate some of the discussion that can go on with someone that has a poor appetite trying to figure out what they want to eat. Instead of having that discussion the day of, plan the meal times and what the actual meal or snack will be, and then follow that schedule the next day. It's important to get plenty of fluids. Most individuals need between 6 and 8 cups of fluid a day, and this would be non-alcoholic fluid and limiting the caffeine as well. For some people, limiting portions of fat-containing foods or limiting the use of extra fats can help with minimizing symptoms. It's important to choose foods that are dense in nutrients, so going for complex carbohydrates, fruits, vegetables, proteins, and I'll get a little bit more in depth in a moment. And then also being active. Being active can help promote normal digestive function. It can also help promote appetite. As I stated earlier, diarrhea can be a big concern for patients with pancreatic cancer. It could be related to the cancer itself or the treatments, or it could be a side effect of surgery. Regardless of the cause of diarrhea, some things that you can do during active diarrhea is to limit or avoid lactose-containing foods or utilize lactase supplements. So a brand name would be Lactaid. You can use Lactaid products or you can use Lactaid pills to help with digesting the lactose that can contribute to diarrhea. Someone's actively having multiple loose bowel movements, we also recommend decreasing insoluble fiber. And a lot of the times this might be referred to as roughage. So these are going to be foods like whole grains, raw fruits with thick peels, and raw vegetables. And again, these are great foods in general, but during a period of having diarrhea, this can make diarrhea worse. Also foods that are sweetened with sugar alcohols, such as sorbitol or mannitol, and foods that are sweetened with highly sweetened foods, such as sugar beverages, can make diarrhea worse. Instead, it can be helpful to include more foods with soluble fiber. So these are going to be things like apple without a peel, bananas, oats, and citrus without membrane. This can help thicken the stool. Also, with loose bowel movements, we often lose potassium and sodium. So using high potassium and high sodium foods is a way to help replace those electrolyte losses. And, of course, getting adequate fluid. So above and beyond that general baseline need of 6 to 8 cups, getting additional fluids. Oftentimes we will recommend an additional 1 cup of fluid for each loose bowel movement. And concentrating on electrolyte-containing fluids, such as children's electrolyte drinks, sports drinks that are diluted, or oral rehydration solutions. Now, diarrhea could be related to pancreatic enzyme insufficiency. So the common symptoms of pancreatic enzyme or pancreatic exocrine insufficiency can be feelings of indigestion, cramping after meals, large amounts of gas, foul-smelling gas or stools, stools that are floating, stools that are greasy or seeing an oiliness in the commode, also light-colored stools. Typically, a light tan or a yellow color can indicate undigested fat in the stool. If the stool is more of a white or gray color, that can relate back to the biliary blockage that Dr. Schroff discussed. So it's important to communicate these variances in stools with your medical team. Also, frequent stools, loose stools, or diarrhea, and unexplained weight loss in the setting of normal eating and normal calorie intake can be symptoms of pancreatic enzyme insufficiency. So how do we correct this? If you have these symptoms, it's important to discuss the symptoms with your healthcare team. It might be that a prescription for pancreatic enzymes can help reduce these symptoms and help improve your absorption of food and help with maintaining weight and side effect management. As Dr. Schroff discussed, with pain medication, often those pain medications can lead to constipation, or in the setting of pancreatic enzyme insufficiency where we would commonly see loose or frequent stools, if somebody is taking pain medication, that constipating effect of the pain medication may mask those frequent or loose stools. So patients could have pain that they're taking pain medication for, and they could have pancreatic exocrine insufficiency that they would be treated best by prescription enzymes to help correct those symptoms. So it's important on a bowel regimen to be taking laxative or stool softeners and that we treat that pancreatic enzyme insufficiency. Now, every person is different and every person needs different amounts of pancreatic enzymes. And this is something that I hear from patients as I educate across the country, is that the amount really varies, and the amount varies depending from patient to patient, but also on the disease, the treatment for the disease, and the amount of fat within a meal or within the diet. So it's important to get started on enzymes and titrate the dose to help minimize those symptoms of pancreatic exocrine insufficiency. And really finding the brand that works and sticking with that brand and dose that works for you. The brands that are available are not one-for-one equivalent to each other. They're similar, but for some people, one brand works better than another, so finding what works and just sticking with that. Now, what should we eat? Well, first of all, I think it's important that every food choice, that we not have any guilt associated with the foods that we're choosing. And ultimately, there are times during treatment where we may be able to make better or healthier food choices than others. For example, when somebody has active diarrhea, we recommend reducing the fiber in the diet, which is contrary to what we think of as being healthy. So taking into account each day what we're dealing with as far as side effects and abilities to eat and make those choices with foods. But in general, we need protein, and protein with each meal and each snack. And we get protein from lean cuts of meat, from beans, peas, lentils, from low-fat or fat-free dairy products, also from eggs. Many people prefer milk alternatives, so things like soy, hemp milk, or fortified almond milk. Meat alternatives such as tofu, veggie burgers, as well as protein powders and nuts and seeds can be great sources of protein. We want to also include fruits, vegetables, and complex carbohydrates to round out those meals. We can get additional calories from fat, such as olive oil, canola oil, avocado, olives, and nuts and seeds. But these should really be used as tolerated, and typically including these additional fats in the diet will, if a patient is taking pancreatic enzymes, they will need to take additional pancreatic enzymes to help with those fat digestion and get full calories. Sometimes patients choose to use liquid nutritional supplements, especially if the appetite is poor or if they're feeling full after solid foods. And these are some things that are commercially available, such as Boost or Ensure, or products such as Orgain or Inu. There are also diabetic versions, such as Glucerna or Boost Glucose Control. And I always recommend for patients that are at home drinking supplements, rather than drinking a supplement, is to make a smoothie. That way you really have a more variety of flavors, variety of options for including protein in those protein powders. A simple smoothie.
This is wonderful. This is a fantastic array of information. I think we're going to actually have some questions for you during the Q&A, because I see questions even coming in before we've even gotten to them. So I want to thank you for this excellent presentation, and we're going to have you come on again for a question during the Q&A. So thank you. Very comprehensive and always wonderful. Thank you, and very helpful to our participants. Our next speaker is Ms. Liz Ezra. Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. Ms. Ezra will address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. Ms. Ezra?
Thank you, Carolyn. I am happy to be part of this important call today. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with pancreatic cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate a healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copayment assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a pancreatic patient telephone support group, and there is also a specific caregiver group that's online. We do have a financial grant for helping people back and forth to treatment, and as I said, there is a copay foundation area that can help with the chemo costs. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can learn a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatments you need to receive. We just did a fact sheet on questions to ask when diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and to get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker will help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you, and thank you for the attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you so much, Liz, for that excellent presentation as well. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And I'm going to try to take as many questions as possible during the Q&A. And so, Stephanie, could you explain to us how to queue up the questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Mr. Emil S. Your line is open.
Yes, two questions. Immunology was never mentioned as a treatment for this cancer. Is it preferable or is it used? And two, can the body function if the pancreas is surgically removed? Can the body cope with that?
Excellent questions, Emil. Thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. O'Reilly if you could address those questions.
Yes, so thank you for those. So the first question pertains to the role of immunotherapy, and we did briefly touch on this, that thus far, immune therapy approaches haven't as yet had the same success that we've seen in other diseases. Having said that, there is a very small subset of people with pancreas cancer where the disease arises on a certain genetic background called Lynch syndrome, or they have features in their cancer called microsatellite instability. It's about 1, maybe 1.5% of people with pancreas cancer. And in that setting, we do see immune therapies having a significant role, and there are a number of studies evaluating the role in that particular setting. So that's one context. For the broader group of people with pancreas cancer, the drugs that have had a lot of publicity in lung and kidney and bladder and melanoma cancers called checkpoint inhibitors, we haven't seen the same signals in pancreas cancer. So the current strategies are looking at combining different immune therapy approaches together, combining immune therapy and chemotherapy or radiation or immune therapy along with vaccines to see if some of the inherent resistance in pancreas cancer can be overcome and to see if the environment which supports pancreas cancer can be made more favorable to facilitate immune responses in tumors. So that's a very active area of research. So to the second question, can the body function with the pancreas removed? So the answer is yes. In pancreas cancer, most surgeries that are done leave part of the pancreas. So for head of pancreas tumors, the most common site, the operation is a Whipple surgery, and the left side or the body and tail of the pancreas are typically in place. For tumors that arise in the mid portion or the body of the pancreas or the left portion called the tail, that operation is called a distal pancreatectomy, and the head of the pancreas is retained in that setting. And usually that remaining pancreas has some residual function in terms of controlling blood sugar with a series of hormones, and Maria elucidated this very nicely, the function regarding what we call exocrine function in terms of enzymes and breaking down, digesting, and absorbing what we eat. Very occasionally in pancreas cancer, a complete pancreatic resection or a total pancreatectomy is done, or sometimes it's done in a preventative context, and there we need to induce measures to ensure good glucose control by insulin, and that can be a sort of a tight balance sometimes, and for sure in terms of exocrine function replacement.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Irene. What is the status of LDN? I'm going to ask Dr. Shroff if you could address this question. What is the status of LDN for pancreatic cancer? Are there any studies? Dr. Shroff, are you able to address this question?
LDM?
N, like Nancy, LDN.
LDN. Dr. O'Reilly, do you know exactly what LDN is referring to?
I'm guessing it's an acronym for something, but it's not
right.
It immediately comes to mind. If the person maybe asking would like to elaborate.
So, Irene, if you could just send a follow-up email with what that stands for, we'd be happy to try to address that. Thank you. And our next question is one of our online participants for Dr. Shroff. I am receiving Lyrica for my constant neuropathy in my hands. And feet. It was recently increased to 115 milligram BID to TID. On a side note, I also have MS where I have this neuropathy prior to my chemo. Is there anything else that could be tried? So this is a very specific question from Barbara. I'm wondering if Dr. Shroff could just address this in a general way in terms of the use of Lyrica for neuropathy and also coordinating with other physicians who may be treating one when you have another comorbid health problem. In this case, it's MS, but it could be other health problems where people often need to collaborate with other treating physicians in treating their neuropathy.
Sure. Yes, no, that's an excellent question. Just as you alluded to, neuropathy is obviously a very big issue in terms of side effects from both oxaliplatin as well as the nab-paclitaxel that we were referring to previously. And there does oftentimes come a point in time where medication needs to be utilized for these. There is not a clear study that has looked at which medication may work best in the setting of pancreas cancer, but there is some data that supports the utilization of Lyrica, as you mentioned, for oxaliplatin-related neuropathy. And what it does seem to show some benefit, especially as you ramp it up to that 3 times a day maximum dose of the Lyrica. You know, I'll be honest when I say that it seems to be an individual-by-individual basis in terms of what seems to work for patients, because there's other drugs such as gabapentin that work in a similar manner to Lyrica, and some actually even older drugs that also seem to play a role in helping with neuropathic pain. In addition, there's other complementary or integrative approaches. There are some patients who have tried and utilized acupuncture for relief. And so there's both medication as well as other complementary things that could be considered. And it just goes back to what I was mentioning previously about utilizing a palliative care or supportive care program in addition to an oncology program for the management of these patients. It helps with managing patients who have other comorbidities that could be contributing to the neuropathy. I mean, diabetes, a lot of our patients with pancreas cancer, we know diabetes is a risk factor and have had longstanding diabetes and already have underlying neuropathy from their diabetes. And then as a result, and then in addition, we're giving them these chemotherapies that can exacerbate it or worsen it. And so oftentimes our supportive care doctors really work with us to help tease out what types of pains we're trying to control. Is this, you know, pain from pancreas cancer and irritating the nerves? Is this neuropathic pain from the drugs that we're utilizing? And as a result, they can help direct a pain program, a pain management program, both using drugs such as gabapentin or Lyrica for neuropathic pain in addition to, say, a narcotic medicine, and perhaps even a referral to an integrative medicine program that could provide acupuncture and see if those types of approaches provide some relief. And so I think it just further underscores the importance of a palliative care or supportive care team.
And then also, of course, for Barbara having had neuropathy prior to chemo due to her MS, I guess involving her MS physician, her neurologist, would be a very important
absolutely.
Part of
this. Absolutely.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you so much. Excellent question, Barbara, and I hope this is helpful to you. And Irene did come back. So the LDN stands for low-dose naltrexone.
Yes, as I said, I didn't know. I figured that's what
it
was.
Our audience is incredibly inventive and online making acronyms that sometimes are. So thank you, Irene, for that clarification. And now Dr. O'Reilly or Dr. Shroff, do you want to address this question about, so the question was, what is the status of LDN for pancreatic cancer? Are there any studies?
Dr. O'Reilly, would you like me to do this or you?
Sure. I'm glad to add a comment or two. So I think this is an intriguing concept, and it's using a drug that is more conventionally used for reversing sedation from narcotics, a drug called naltrexone, and designed to block certain receptors or proteins on cell membranes to see if we can make the cells more sensitive to certain substances that the body releases and ultimately induce cancer cell death. It's been looked at in a variety of medical settings. I think immune-related diseases such as autoimmune diseases is a context, and certainly it's been a topical question in the context of cancer. I would say that it wouldn't be an established treatment, and I think it is something that has to be done carefully, especially if for people who may be on narcotic medications, because theoretically you could be interfering with how those drugs might work. And this and many, there are many other examples of sort of complementary techniques that are being evaluated for pancreas cancer. So I would say not a mainstream approach, but there is some interesting science behind this. But I think it has to be done in a right setting with appropriate monitoring.
Excellent. And Dr. Schwab, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, I mean, I completely agree with you. I think, you know, investigating it, I think, is a very important component, but in a very monitored manner so that we can truly understand what it does in terms of pancreas cancer as opposed to what we know it has routinely and previously been utilized for. So I completely agree.
Quite a remarkable participant today. I must say, I want to thank our speakers. You've been outstanding. I want to thank, actually, our audience for their great questions. I know we haven't answered all your questions, but I do want to be respectful of everyone's time on the call today. I want to thank all of you who've both asked questions on the phone and online. And I did say at the beginning that I would let you know how to get your questions answered if we didn't get your question. So I do want to actually identify for anyone who has lingering medical questions, of course, going back to your healthcare team, even after today's program, with anything you might have learned today, you want to take this information back to your healthcare team. But if you have a question that you would like to actually get some additional information on, I always recommend the National Cancer Institute as a wonderful resource, 1-800-422-6237. It's a wonderful resource for all of you to access information in terms of any questions that you may have. Their information specialists are especially trained to address your questions, and they are quite excellent. The other group I would say is the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, and they're listed in all materials here at 1-877-435-8650. It's a wonderful resource, and their website. All that information will be sent again to all of you, but they're a terrific resource as well, as many of our other organizations. If, however, you have a desire to participate in one of our many of the programs that Ms. Ezra identified, Ms. Ezra coordinates our pancreatic cancer program here at Cancer Care, individual counseling, telephone counseling, joining a telephone support group or an online support group, either as a person living with pancreatic cancer or a caregiver, please do contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Also, we do have practical assistance for people, financial assistance, we have publications, and we have workshops as well, so that there's quite an array of services that you can access. And if it's something we don't have, we'll definitely connect you up with others who can help you, other organizations. Also, I do want to remind everybody that we do have a part two of today's program, and that one is focusing on caregivers. However, people living with pancreatic cancer are welcome to attend as well. That's for caregivers coping with your loved one's pancreatic cancer. For some of you, you may have a caregiver. For some of you, you may be your caregiver. So please do listen in on that program as well. Many of you have signed up for both programs, but just in case, and it occurs on November 16th, and we welcome you to participate in that program. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want any one of you to feel like you're alone. Also, this is a time of year, as we approach holidays and things like that, it kind of brings up ideas in everyone's mind, all kinds of thoughts. And I think I do want you to know that you are connected here, that if you need to talk with someone, of course your healthcare team where you're getting care is an excellent resource. But if you need an additional resource, please do feel free to contact our staff here at Cancer Care. Our oncology social workers are here, and they're here to help you. I want to thank you all for your participation today. You've really been an outstanding audience. I must say the questions you've asked have been really top-notch in terms of just questions that are really rather cutting-edge. You're very inventive and very good questions. And again, I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.